So go on into some reflections about this this person, this human called the Buddha. Several of you in your reflections named this his humanity as one of the central qualities. And I think it's important for so many of us that this this figure that came to be the center of a religion and came to be abstracted into a cosmic quality of, you know, perfect wisdom and, you know, infinite knowing and clarity. And the term originally just pointed to the teacher that laid out this body of teachings that was so tremendously helpful for so many people and influential and lasted so long and outlasted the teaching of so many of his contemporaries, really became one of the pinnacle teachings, bodies of philosophy and logic and practice in all of the world's written traditions and modern traditions. So the Buddha lived in the 5th century before the Common Era in an area known as Greater Magadha. This was a large collection of kingdoms in between the Himalayas and the river Ganga in what's called the Indo-Gangetic Plain. And he was originally a prince in the a royal or you know, governing family, the Sakyan family. And his area was probably something like an oligarchy run by a collection of wealthy, powerful families. His was one of those. And so his father was the ruler of a small area there, and he was raised quite wealthy. He was set up in an arranged marriage in his 20s and had a child. But when his child was young, in some stories newborn, in some stories a little bit later, he left his family in the care of his extended family and went to join the groups of wandering ascetics that were common in his area at that time. And he seems to have been motivated by the fear of death initially. And this was made into sort of mythic form in the story of, you know, as a young man, him leaving, sneaking out of his palace into the city, sort of sneaking away from a life of privilege and sheltered upbringing into the city, and seeing an old person, a sick person, and a corpse, and so getting the first hint of old age, sickness, and death. These three sites are called the divine messengers. And so many aspects of the Buddha's life story originally seem to have been fairly straightforward human biographical details, like what you might see if you were sheltered and you snuck out of the palace and you went into, you know, an early city, what you might see. And later on, they were mythologized. So a myth arose around these divine messengers that the gods worried that the Buddha would become complacent in his privilege and not take up the life of seeking and awaken, and so set him up to feel that curiosity that took him outside the walls. And then the gods in disguise took on the form of an old person, a sick person, and a corpse crossing his path, so that he would be forced to reckon with the realities of old age, sickness, and death. In any case, these are said to have really shaken him to the core. And he reflected, you know, if this is the inevitable end of life, what use are the pleasures that my life is composed of right now? So he really thinks about the place of, you know, in the text, not so much the what we might call the wholesome pleasures of the lay life, you know, having a stable, good family life, but really the pleasures of wealth and privilege that he was immersed in. What good these are if they can't actually forestall or prevent these painful inevitabilities, old age, sickness, and death. He goes out a fourth time, the texts tell us, and sees a shramana, an ascetic wanderer, someone in monk's robes, wandering with a bowl, who has such a peaceful bearing that he's struck. He says, this person carries themselves differently than anyone else in the city. What are they? Who are they? And his charioteer, his driver, says, you know, this is an ascetic. This is one who has left the home life to seek for peace, living in the wilderness, seeking peace. And so the Buddha vows to take up that life, and he does. And he initially practices with two well-known meditation teachers of the time. Scholars think that these were real people, so that and there's some suggestion that his taking up with these teachers might actually have happened before he left the palace, that he may have had some significant amount of meditative training even as a layperson before he left. But in the story that comes down in the Pali canon, he leaves home, studies with these two teachers, masters their practices, but finds that they, although they are powerful practices, that they don't lead to the permanent end of suffering and freedom from the fear of death and loss that he has been suffering from. And so he leaves them to continue searching, and he practices the intense ascetic disciplines that were common and popular in his time, tormenting the body for several years, almost starving himself to death, eventually also realizing that these were not conducive to liberation. This realization that one of you mentioned in our go around leads to the middle way, his discovery of the middle way, that neither sensual indulgence nor bodily mortification, or, you know, causing pain to the body, self-harm, we would say, purifies the heart. Neither one is a condition for freedom. And so abandoning both, he takes up the middle way, nourishes the body, takes care of himself, brings himself back to health, and then, supported by the gift of milk rice from Sujata, we talked about a couple weeks ago, and her blessing, as she said to him, as my aim was realized, so may yours be. And she gave him this gift of profound nourishment, and became the first laywoman devotee. He nourished the body, and in his final night of practice, directed his mind to the recognition of his past lives, seeing the revolving of birth and death in an endless sequence, endless until it ends, but beginningless is really the right term there, in a beginningless sequence. Thousands, millions of lives, cosmic eons expanding and contracting. He understands that everything just arises and passes based on conditions. And because of this, that death is not to be feared, right? Death isn't the end of anything, actually. And so his fear of old age, sickness, and death was actually just a fear of being embedded on the wheel of conditions, the wheel of karma. Seeing this, he directs his attention outward to other people and sees that this is true for everyone, and that people's actions lead to their future rebirths. So he really makes the connection between ethics and existence. So the first insight is into the beginningless nature of birth and death. And the second insight he has is into the connection between our actions and our future states of mind, states of being, births. With those two insights, he understood and saw clearly why we return. Not so much why we return, but why we suffer again and again. And dropping the fear of old age, sickness, and death, dropping the resistance to conditions being what they are, that everything is impermanent, the body is impermanent. That was the third insight of uprooting the defilements, really ending the cycle of suffering. It turns out that when you end the cycle of suffering, you also end the cycle of rebirth, because they're not separate, right? Rebirth, it just means rebirth into suffering. Bodies come and go. That's the nature of things. The Buddha's body was born and it aged and it had back pain and it died. It was sick. It got well. It was a human body, lived to be 80 years old. The Buddha recovered from the fear of death and loss, and in doing so, was no longer subject to turning and turning through craving and fear. Following this experience, he wasn't sure what to do. He reflected that what he had found was tremendously subtle, and he had to be persuaded, the myths say, by a visiting god, Brahma Sahampati, came down to say, you should teach, or he had an intuition to teach. And when he did, he first went to seek out his friends that he had most recently been practicing with. He went to find his friends and told them this new path that he had found. They were still committed to the ascetic path, and he convinced them that this wasn't the way. It took them a moment to believe him. But he was so radiant and so different from the person they had known before that they believed him. And in short order, in the matter of a couple of talks, they all were able to realize the truth that he had found. And many of his first disciples were already practitioners. He initially focused not on converting lay people, but on converting followers from other traditions. He poached other teachers' students. To the point where other teachers were like, they would say to their students, like, don't go debate with Gotama. He converts everybody who goes to talk with him. You know, if you go to talk with him, you know, I'll lose you. So most of his early students were practitioners from other traditions, with the exception of this one kid who was 20-something years old, and he was the son of Sujata, who had given the Buddha the milk rice. She had prayed at the tree 20 years before for a child, had been given a child, and had been making an offering to that tree every year for 20 years. And so 20 years after her kid was born, there was the Buddha sitting at the base of the tree. She gave him the offering, realizing that this was a very special year for her yearly offering ritual. She was a wealthy, she was a wealthy person in the town, and she had a son named Yasa. And he was kind of a playboy. He liked to party. He was a little bit shallow. The texts kind of give a sense. And he had these 50 friends who were kind of his buddies. So he kind of had this party crew, but he had a devotional temperament. He had a contemplative temperament, and so the Buddha's still in the vicinity of where he was awakened. So in the vicinity of the town where Sujata and her son lived, and one day, one night after a party, it said Yasa was out walking. You know. I have this sense that, like, you know, he's coming home from the club late at night or something, and he starts, you know, talking to himself, and he's saying, like, what's it about? What's it about? You know, and the Buddha kind of psychically has known that he's, he's going to be in a conducive frame of mind. And the Buddha, you know, shows up in his path and says, Yasa, come with me. I'll show you what it's about. And teaches him. And right away, Yasa gains stream entry. And so Yasa collects all of his friends, and they become some of the first monastics. They become, after the first five friends, they are the next 51 monastics. And then the Buddha converts like 500 students of this one other teacher who's around. And that's the first crew of monks that's around him. So the stories of the Buddha from his childhood through his awakening, those are the ones that are told most often. They're the ones that contain his struggle, his doubt, the complicated bits around his family. You know, they contain the struggle to realize freedom, which is the part in a certain way that we resonate with most. When they make a dramatic movie about the Buddha, which has been made a couple of times, you know, it's mostly about his search for freedom. It's not really about what happens after, because once somebody is liberated, there's no drama anymore. Like, it's hard to write the movie and make it go past the awakening in a certain way, the same way that it's hard to write a romance that goes past the wedding night, right? The romance is all about the meeting and the dating and the drama until you're finally committed. But once you're committed, right, the old stories, you know, always ended with a marriage. They would never say what actually happens after that. You know, I grew up Catholic, and it was, it was always clear that there was something poignant and important, but also kind of unsatisfying about the fact that Jesus, you know, taught for 3 years and then was killed. And then he has this, you know, miraculous, rebirth, resurrection, we called it. And then, you know, disappears a few days later. And some stories say he went back to India and lived the rest of his life there teaching. So you can check that out. Jesus in India, find some documentaries on that. But the Buddha's life was not like that. He was awakened, and then he did the long, slow, very human task of building an intentional community. He built a community of friends, of practitioners, initially men, and then very famously, at the urging of his aunt and stepmother, Mahapajapati, admitted women into the order and built an order of women monastics. And taught for nearly 50 years, till he was 80 years old. He built a vast collection of teaching, built a very strong monastic sangha with a strong collection of rules and guidelines. And when he died, he left a very strong community. And he said that he wouldn't die until he had established the fourfold sangha: ordained men, ordained women, lay men and lay women, that were strong enough to continue in his absence. So we mostly talk about the beginning of his life, and then we tell the teachings from the middle of his life. I wanted tonight to tell a couple short stories about the end of his life, and to touch on friendship, and particularly one relationship that he had with his cousin Ananda. His cousin Ananda joined the monastic order some years after the Buddha began teaching, but relatively early in his teaching life, and Ananda was his attendant then for the rest of his life, and he memorized all the teachings the Buddha ever gave, and after the Buddha's death recited the entire body of teachings at the first monastic council. Ananda is beloved in the texts for being kind and warm, a very generous teacher, but also for not being fully liberated until after the Buddha's death. Most of the Buddha's close disciples become arahants, are fully liberated. And Ananda isn't. He attains stream entry and then nothing more for the whole of the Buddha's life, which is amazing. He memorized every single teaching, but I sort of think of him like, he's a little bit like, you know, the Muggle in Hogwarts. You know, everyone else is a full wizard and he's kind of not quite there yet. He doesn't have all of his magic yet. And this becomes a thing in his story later on. But in the days before the Buddha's death, there's a few really poignant episodes concerning Ananda, and some of them are interestingly almost difficult in the narrative. And so I want to read a couple of them to you. And partly I want us to think about the Buddha as an 80-year-old man, as an elder, an old man. He's been walking around for 50 years teaching,
people have tried to kill him. You know, he's tried to stop a war on multiple occasions. He's been engaged in politics. So much has happened. And he's built this incredible community. And here he is. He knows he's going to die somewhat soon. The initiating event is a meal possibly of bad pork or of bad mushrooms. It's hard to say in the translation. And so he's dying of food poisoning. He prolongs his life for a few months so that all the monks can gather and be with him. And he starts walking toward his home, but he's not going to make it. He's gonna end up dying in Kusinara between a pair of flowering sal trees on the road. But a little while before this, he's with Ananda, and he says, they're near the town of Vesali, and he says to Ananda, well, first of all, right before this, he says this. Ananda says, Lord, I have seen the Lord in comfort, and I have seen the Lord's patient enduring. And Lord, my body was like a drunkard's. I lost my bearings, and things were unclear to me because of the Lord's sickness. The only thing that was some comfort to me was the thought, the Lord will not attain final nibbana until he has made some statement about the order of monks. Ananda is saying a bit like, you know, who's your successor going to be? Are you going to make some grand statement before you die? And the Buddha says, but Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dhamma, Ananda, making no inner and outer. The Tathagata has no teacher's fist in respect of doctrines. Like I haven't held any secret doctrines. I haven't held anything back. If there is anyone who thinks I shall take charge of the order or the order should refer to me, let them make some statement about the order. But the Tathagata does not think in such terms. Ananda, I am now old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up. It is only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by cessation of certain feelings enters into the signless concentration of mind that his body knows comfort. He's in pain. He's in pain all the time. And he's holding his body together just barely with the force of concentration. And he says that he's only really comfortable when he withdraws from sensation into deep, signless meditation. Therefore, Ananda, and this is one of the famous sayings at the end of the Buddha's life, you should live as islands unto yourselves. The term islands is the Pali word dipa, and it can mean both island and lamp. So you can take it as a double entendre or a pun, but this is translated sometimes as be an island unto yourself. That's a metaphor that's been used frequently in the Buddha's life, like be an island in the flood, so a safe place amid the rushing waters. But it's also translated as
as you should be a lamp unto yourself, like a light, you should be a lamp unto yourself. Be your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island or a lamp, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monastic live as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge? Here, Ananda, a monastic abides, contemplating the body as a body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, having put away hankering and fretting for the world. This is Maurice Walsh's kind of antique translation. And likewise, with regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects, that, Ananda, is how a monastic lives as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time or afterwards that live thus, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning. And this is really core to the end of his life, that he says, you know, he doesn't name a successor. He doesn't say, you know, follow this person or do this thing. He says, I've taught you everything. I've given you the foundations of mindfulness, and, you know, be a refuge unto yourself. Everyone is, it's kind of an anarchic system. Everyone is their own teacher. You know, you can have a teacher, but you can be a refuge unto yourself. And if you need to turn to anything, cultivate the foundations of mindfulness, right? Knowing the body, knowing feelings, knowing mind and mind objects. This is the teacher once the Buddha is gone. Then the Lord, or the Buddha, rising early, dressed, went for alms, and then said, bring a mat, Ananda. We will go to the Kapala shrine for the siesta. So Ananda and the Buddha go to the Kapala shrine. All right, this is a poignant story. This is one of the strange stories. I'm not sure I understand it, but I'll tell you what it is. Ananda says to the Buddha, Ananda, Visali is delightful, the Udena shrine is delightful, the Gotamaka shrine is delightful, the Satambaka shrine is delightful, the Bahuputta shrine is delightful, the Kapala shrine is delightful. All of these are beautiful places. He's saying, like, all these places, they're so beautiful. Then he says this, Ananda, whoever has developed the four roads to power, these are the Iddhipadas, the bases of power in the body, practiced them frequently, made them their vehicle, made them their base, established them, could undoubtedly live for a century or the remainder of one. Sometimes that's translated as an eon or the remainder of one. The Tathagata has developed these powers, and he could, Ananda, undoubtedly live for a century or an eon or the remainder of one. But the Venerable Ananda, failing to grasp this broad hint, this clear sign, did not beg the Lord, Lord, may the Blessed One stay for a century. May the welfarer stay for a century for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans. So much was his mind possessed by Mara. And a second time and a third time, the same thing happened. Then the Buddha said, Ananda, go now and do what seems fitting to you. Very good, Lord. And Ananda rose from his seat, bowed, passed him on the right, and sat down under a tree some distance away. This story sometimes breaks my heart and sometimes seems mythically like what had to happen. The Buddha gives an obvious hint to Ananda that if he chose, he could stay alive for the remainder of the eon. And the text says straight out, Ananda didn't get the hint. And later on, the Buddha is going to say to Ananda, Ananda's going to say, oh, Blessed One, can't you use your power to stay alive for an eon? So a little while after this, what's going to happen next? I want to read you the whole thing, but we don't have time. What's going to happen next is that Mara comes to the Buddha, and Mara says, oh, Blessed One, you've fulfilled what you wanted to do. You have the fourfold Sangha. You've completed all your teaching. Give up the life force. Let it go. And the Buddha says, enough, Mara, I'll do it when I'm ready. But shortly thereafter, the Buddha sits down under a tree, mindful and fully aware, and lets go of the life force. And when he does, and this precedes his death by a few months, but he lets go of holding on. And when he does, there's an earthquake, and like the skies shake, which happens when Buddhas are born and when they're enlightened and when they let go of the life force nearing their death. And Ananda comes to the Buddha and says, "What happened, Blessed One? Why is there an earthquake?" And the Buddha says, "There's only an earthquake for a few reasons, you know, when a Blessed One is born, when they're awakened, when they let go of the life force, a couple other reasons." And Ananda says, Blessed One, stay alive for the eon. Use your power to remain." And the Buddha says, "Ananda, I gave you the hint 3 times and you missed it. It's too late. The Blessed One will attain final nibbana shortly." How do we take this? How do we take this? The Buddha loves Ananda. And a few pages later in the text, the Buddha goes on for pages praising Ananda and how beautiful he is and how devoted he is. And right before the Buddha dies, Ananda, it says, you know, the Buddha announces his death to the monastics, his pending death. And Ananda collapses against the door frame weeping. And, you know, the elder monks who are fully liberated, and remember, Ananda's not yet, they say, like, "Ananda, why are you weeping?" And Ananda says, "The Blessed One is dying. How can we practice without him?" And the Buddha says, "Ananda, what have I been teaching you all this time?" So there's such love, such friendship between these men. The Buddha is 80, Ananda's a little bit younger, but these are old men talking with each other. And Ananda's weeping at losing the Buddha. And this strange moment where the Buddha gives him a hint, he doesn't get it. And then the Buddha later lays it right in front of him. What is this doing? What's happening here, right? There's something that the myth, I think, is telling us about being human and being friends and our responsibility to each other. You know, there's some way that the story of the Buddha and his humanity wouldn't quite work if Ananda had gotten the hint and said, "Stay alive for an eon," and the Buddha was like, "Okay," you know, and he would still be alive now. There's, you know, it's almost like it's this final moment of this profound poignancy that, you know, his body is breaking down already. You know, he's just said, "My body is like an old cart held together with straps. I'm only comfortable when I rest into deep meditation." And maybe it's true that with his power, he could have, you know, stayed alive for a very long time. But there's something right also about him being so human that at 80, with a body breaking down, he says, you know, "I'm not going to hold on any longer. Like, I'm done. I've done what I came here to do." And he consciously surrenders the life force. So I want to chat about this. Is there anything else? This is a long discourse. I think we'll just keep talking about this for a while. Here's the last bit. Here we go. Ananda weeps against the door frame. And he's crying, lamenting. And the Buddha says, "Where's Ananda? Bring him to me." So they bring Ananda. "Friend Ananda, the teacher summons you." And the Buddha said, "Enough, Ananda. Do not weep and wail. Have I not already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming other? Have I not already told you?" He's saying this to the person who's memorized every discourse he's ever given. Of course he's told him. Right? So how could it be, Ananda, since whatever is born, become, compounded, is subject to decay, how could it be that it should not pass away? For a long time, Ananda, you have been in the Tathagata's presence, showing loving kindness in act of body, speech, and mind, beneficially, blessedly, wholeheartedly, and unstintingly. You have achieved much merit, Ananda. Make the effort, and in a short time, you will be free of the corruptions. Then the Lord addressed the monks. "Monks, all those who were arahant, fully enlightened Buddhas in the past have had just such a chief attendant as Ananda, and so too will those blessed lords who come in the future. Monastics, Ananda is wise.
He knows when it is the right time for monastics to come and see the fall of the Tathagata, when it's the right time for all other kinds of people to come. Ananda has wonderful qualities. He goes on and praises Ananda all this time. And then Ananda says, oh, don't, well, at least don't pass away in this like miserable little town in the back of beyond. And the Buddha says, don't say that. In times past, this was a magnificent capital, and gives a whole story about where they are. They're just on the outskirts of some tiny village in the middle of the forest. Anyway, so I'm thinking about these two old men who are dear friends. One of them's about to die, and the other one is figuring out how to be with that. And really, I think they're figuring out how to be with each other in this very momentous moment. They've been together for so long. All right, so.